Good afternoon and good morning. Welcome to your February 8th Committee on Rules. I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 10. For the audience or for committee members, we're not going to go into work session today, but we intend to move the bill next week with one sort of huge amendment, assuming our wonderful folks from Legislative Council can get that accomplished. I'm just going to do a walkthrough of what the new amendment will be drafted to include, unless I get too much pushback from committee members, and I guess now is your opportunity to scream or forever hold your peace kind of thing. So in terms of the commission funding, looking at amendment number one from last week, Legislative Council has reported that if a person is currently exempt under the GSP definition of public official, they'll be exempt under the Dash 1 amendment. So that's my understanding. If there are questions, Mr. Bretling is in the room. This amendment does exempt unelected volunteers. Go ahead. Question, Lori.
Yeah, question. Thank you. We have had some incidences where PTAs have had people misuse the funds. Ordinarily, would someone like that go through GSPC, or is that through another jurisdiction, through a law process?
Thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson. Mr. Reutlinger, thanks for being here this morning.
You're welcome. For the record, Ted Reutlinger from Legislative Council. The answer to your question depends upon whether members of a PTA are public officials under this definition. And I do not know the answer to that question off the top of my head. I mean, to the extent that they serve a public body, which is a school district, in theory they could be public officials under that law. But I do not know if the GSPC has interpreted the law to cover those folks.
Thank you. So we've asked Mr. Burson to come on up. Mr. Burson, any thoughts on whether PTA volunteers are covered under the definition of public officials?
Again, for the record, Ron Burson, Executive Director for GSPC. I do not know of any instances where PTA members have come up as public officials. I think Mr. Reutlinger had spelled it out pretty well there, that they would need to have some type of official tie to the public body. And as I understand it, PTA members are a volunteer organization, I don't believe that would be underneath ours.
Thank you. Senator Mona Sanderson, anything to
say? And then one other question. We have people on budget committees for the school districts, and they are involved in contract and obtaining contracts. School boards do that too, but they also bring in school boards are elected, so that's not a problem. But if there was a situation where there was favoritism, or they are involved in the budget process and maybe did something that wasn't quite appropriate, would that come under GSPC, or would that go somewhere else?
Chair Brown, Mona Sanderson, a budget committee that was working for the school district, they would have that administrative function for the public body. And if they had a conflict of interest or used their position to benefit themselves financially, then yes, the GSPC would investigate that obligation.
So they would. Some of them are not elected that are on the budget committee, and they are volunteers. So I was wondering then, but you're saying they would come under GSPC.
Senator Mona Sanderson, yes. I think the issue is under commission funding, they're exempted as volunteers for funding purposes. They are not exempt, as I understand it, volunteers for the school district, for example, are not exempt from our ethics statutes because they are considered public officials.
Excellent. Thank you.
Is that helpful?
Yes,
correct.
Very helpful.
Oh, good. We got all three of them nodding. That's a good sign. Sarah Johnson.
And one last comment. In the case of misappropriation or theft of money, GSPC isn't their biggest problem. The DA is.
Right.
It needs to be clarified. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you,
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Crick, we're one of the things we're trying to do here is to define the or create a bright line so we can put people in one place or other. Seems to me with all these questions and everything, every case is still going to have to be decided upon its own merits, and it's just going to be varying shades all the way along. Is that would that be a fair characterization of what we're trying to get with this thing?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, obviously clarity in the ethics law is a good thing, and that's what we're trying to get to. Yes, and your questions are good. And for purposes of this Dash 1 amendment, we're simply trying to define which public officials are counted for purposes of this assessment. This does not in any way change what the ethics laws cover in terms of public officials generally.
All right. Any other questions on this issue? I just want to raise the issue while this wonderful panel is here. Ms. Johnson, you're welcome to stay or leave as you wish. But the other issue that was raised in this Dash 1 amendment was questions about agent or otherwise in the definition of public official. Mr. Ruttlinger, do you want to address that concern, please?
Yes.
Or would you please address that concern?
Yes.
You probably don't. So
this definition is taken pretty much word for word from the existing definition of public official in the election laws. We had to move it into this section because the definitional section in 244.020 doesn't necessarily work for this, but it's exactly the same, so that anybody who is currently subject to the ethics laws as a public official under the original version of this bill would have been counted for purposes of the assessment. So the definition now that defines who is subject to the ethics law and who can be punished for use of office for financial gain or who has to declare conflicts of interest, this language about agents or otherwise is currently the law, and that's what it says now. And an agent, of course, is somebody who has authority to act on behalf of a public body or a public official. And so in some cases, agents are covered by the ethics laws. So basically, this just carries over the existing definition. So any difficulty that might exist with the current definition and interpretation would be carried over here, but it doesn't seem to me in my travels through the ethics law's opinions that this definition has been problematic or unclear about who it applies to.
That solves my problem.
Great. Sarah Nelson, does that raise some for you?
Just goes back to my original thing, agent or otherwise. I mean, that's otherwise. There's not much clarity or
employee
definition there. Otherwise covers a big area. It's Greek to me at this point.
Okay. Great. Thank you. That's what we're trying to do is create.
I don't mean
Greek
that offensive.
Here. No.
I hope I didn't offend you. You've got to be very careful.
All right. Anybody else on this issue? Okay. Thank you very much. In terms of the funding piece, I will be working again with Mr. You guys can go if you want to, but though we may need you, so don't go too far. We're going to continue to work with Legislative Council on the funding piece to draft an amendment that will incorporate the proportionality proposal that we talked about last week. It will assess state agencies at a specific rate. It will divert a portion of revenues going to local government like we talked about. I know that there are concerns about that. It would incorporate the concerns raised by Chuck Bennett and Lori Wimmer regarding appropriation to the Department of Education for the cost of school employees that has been transferred to the GSPC. So under this scenario, we do not need the Dash 2 and the 3 amendments, which would deal with exempting bodies with 100 or 50 less numbers. So comments, questions, concerns? Madam Chair, Senator
just to get
Johnson.
On the record, so there's no ambiguity about this. We are not population controlled in any part of this now. It is a per head count assessment. We're not doing any population, number of souls. It's everybody. I'm not saying this very well. We've had this debate about whether or not we were going to exempt bodies with any number of employees,
correct,
50 and 100. We're now going to a uniform funding mechanism that pulls in everybody.
Every public official.
Every public official.
Except volunteers.
Except volunteers, right.
I was like, I wanted to make sure I got that right. Yes.
Okay.
Senator Farrelly, comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue still for me, and it's not an insurmountable one, I'll be very interested to see how we solve the issue or resolve the issue of the assessment. Really, for me, the challenge is to come up with some funding mechanism that doesn't create a bureaucracy that's expensive to administer. So if it's a head count, you know, we'll have to build some mechanism for people to dispute the head count, because inevitably there'll be some people that fall on one side of the line or the other, and that's going to be a matter of agreement. And if it's a withhold from a revenue sharing or an assessment, that would be a different matter than sending out an actual assessment that has to go through an administrative process, which seems to me that would be expensive. So I'll be interested to learn what the mechanism for accrual will be, whether it'll be withholding dollars that would otherwise be appropriated from the central government, or whether it will be asking the jurisdictions to go through a process to send money back to the central government that they've already received. In the latter, I think you've got a big bureaucratic mess. In the former, it may be less problematic. I would still argue that the cleanest and easiest way is by direct appropriation, once a biennium.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly. I appreciate that. Any other comments on this piece? Senator Nelson.
How do you, are we defining state agencies? At all?
It's a DAS assessment. My recollection, it was a DAS assessment.
A DAS assessment.
Mm-hmm. Department of Administrative Services assessment. So.
What is the scope then? Is it all, does it Thunder River Gorge get assessed?
We'll find out.
Is that a state agency? That may not be a state agency. I don't know. I just trying to clarify the definitions.
You sure you don't want to just assess the guys down in legislative fiscal? I thought that was really...
What?
We just assess the guys down in legislative fiscal $7,500 and call it good.
I'm not sure they would appreciate that, Senator Farrelly. We're gonna get a hold of someone from legislative fiscal at this point so you can get your questions answered. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify regarding the funding piece that hasn't been heard from already or would like to raise something new?
Senator Brown and members of the committee, my name is Norman Turrell with the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I just wanted to ask you about on -1 amendment subsection B. Every time I read this, I come out with a different opinion as to exactly what it says, and it has to do with whether or not part-time employees are excluded from the definition of a public official for the funding purposes. And is that what you intend in this section, or are you really trying to only exempt volunteers who happen to work on a part-time basis?
We're going to have the certified smart person come on up.
So that's my concern, that you remove the ambiguity there.
Thank you, Mr. Pearl.
Turl.
Appreciate you. Turl? I know it rhymes with Pearl. Mr. Rutlinger.
Thank you, Chair. Ted Rutlinger, Legislative Council. The way this is written now, the people who are exempted are anybody who's unelected and is either a volunteer or serves on a part-time basis.
Are exempted from the funding piece.
Exempted from the funding piece.
The funding definition of public official for the funding piece. All right.
So, yes, it does apply to part-time people.
Senator Farrelly.
I just am just compelled to put this on the record.
Please put it on the record, Senator
Farrelly.
I think
that is because the jurisdictions expand and contract in their part-time workforce seasonally and didn't want to count some half of the year and count others as exempt half the year. And so if they just focused on their permanent employees, they could give you a fix on that at a particular moment in time. And I think that's why they wanted the part-timers out of there.
And Senator Farrelly, it's probably more of an issue for the smaller public bodies than the larger ones, but since we didn't exempt the smaller public bodies, the 50 and the 100 and the less than, the two of those, it probably makes sense to include the volunteer or the seasonal part-time as well. Senator Johnson.
I would just respectfully make the observation forestry has a huge cadre of part-time folks during fire season.
Anything else for Mr. Rettlinger on the funding piece? Okay. Moving along to reporting requirements, we will need to wait. Mr. Rocco is in a meeting, and so we'll need to wait for his information. Reporting requirements. New from last week is the Dash 4 amendments, and it's more technical in measure, but address some of the concerns that committee members and members of the public raised, and that is individuals are only required to report gifts if they are given by a lobbyist or a lobbying entity to an SEI filer. So it narrows, frankly, the proportion of the proportion of folks that the reporting requirements would apply to. So it's limiting the universe. So it's drafted based on your concerns, questions, or comments. Anybody in the audience wishing to testify on that particular amendment? I understand that you probably haven't had an extensive time to review it. Senator Nelson.
We were just delivered the latest rules and regulations from the Secretary of State that encompassed about 85 pages of reporting. Well, I mean, there are all sorts of different things in there. And to find out or to figure that or to read that or to understand that is really difficult. And what I think we need is some sort of standardization. And will this amendment get to that standardization of whether I have to report something that's $70 or $100 or $144? How does that all work out?
I'm assuming that the rules are from the Secretary of State's office regarding campaign finance and not regarding ethics, but I have not looked at them. So,
well, they're gifts, and I mean, there are definitions of gifts, and I mean, I think that's a lot of the confusion. Is it which rules are we operating under here?
Okay, well, we'll check that out.
That's what.
In terms of, so we'll check it out.
Okay.
So I think the goal here is to have, once you create a standard that's pretty clear, hopefully it'll be easier for people to comply. Senator Montes Anderson.
So if we are at an event and they have a raffle, you win the raffle, but the gift was from a lobbyist, that gets a little sticky.
Mr. Rettlinger, come on up. Did you pay money for the raffle?
Well, you walk in the door and you're given two tickets.
And everyone's given two tickets. Okay. Mr. Rettlinger.
Madam Chair, Ted Rettlinger, Legislative Council. With this amendment, the Dash 4, just to be clear, does not affect what you, members of the legislature, would have to report. This is only limited to what people who give you gifts would have to report. And what it does is narrow that down to say that it's only lobbyists, basically, who have to report that they have given a gift to a public official that's underneath the limits. So with the raffle, or, you know, if you attend a dinner where somebody has bought you has paid a cost for you to attend a function that is a benefit for a nonprofit organization, for example, I believe that the GSPC reads the law to say that if that the cost of the ticket is simply a donation by the person who pays for it to the nonprofit organization, and then if you are there and enjoy food, beverage in the presence of the people who paid the ticket, then that's exempt under the food and beverage exemption. So I think that's how. Does that address your question?
I think
all about the gift or prize.
If she were to if everyone at the door was handed two tickets and they put those tickets in a raffle barrel, and Mr. Bennett, who lobbies for the Oregon School Boards Association, donated a Ferrari, and Senator Montes Anderson, her raffle ticket came up and she won the Ferrari. Can she keep the Ferrari?
If the raffle ticket was paid for by somebody with a legislative interest and you were there in your capacity as a state senator and you won the Ferrari, I would think that that would violate the gift limit of...
How about a $100 gift pack, which is more reasonable?
How about a $45?
Yeah, and the gift limit now is $100 per calendar year. So anything over that...
She can keep the hubcap.
Maybe. Okay. All right. Mr. Bennett, did you want to come up and testify on this? Ms. Johnson, come on up.
And what is he doing giving away Ferraris? I don't want to know.
I think I'm interested in the dash sixes rather than the dash.
Okay, so I'm going to... I don't even have dash sixes here. Oh, they're back. Okay, all right. I'll hold you back then. Thank you. Ms. Johnson, regarding the dash four amendments, and then we'll go to Senator Johnson. Sorry, I didn't see you.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission, I just wanted to point out that in Senate Bill 10, I don't think you could get the $40 or you could get any meals because you've deleted the meal provisions in this bill. This bill tracks Colorado's requirements, and so it's quite a significant departure, and this is all in Section 16 of the bill.
Okay, no, that's a problem.
So, and I have not heard any testimony on the rewrites of the gift.
Okay, well, that's a good catch. So thank you very much.
Kind of weird. So, in other words, $50. What Ted Littlinger explained was present law, but this bill would significantly change present law regarding gifts.
Mm. All right.
And I want to just be clear on the definition of lobbyist, what we're using as the definition. Anybody registered, anybody with an interest who's advocating for an outcome but maybe falls beneath the required number of hours to register, how are you defining it?
That was my understanding. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, it's defined in this amendment using the definition of lobbyist in the lobbying statutes.
Okay.
So it would cover anybody who's currently a lobbyist registered by the GSPC. And then it goes on to say that if you're a lobbyist that has to file reports, that you can simply report these things on your lobbying statement. You don't have to file a whole separate statement.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, let's move to the Dash 5 amendments, delay the required implementation of the electronic filing system January 1st, 2008 to July 1st of 2009. I think Mr. Burson testified earlier that it would be extremely difficult to get the electronic filing system on board by the date set forth in the bill. So by popular claim, we would delay that to July 1st, 2009. Comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am being informed by members from both sides of the aisle that even the currently existing Secretary of State's electronic filing program has glitched up on us, and there's pieces dropping off of the filings that members are making. So I would just point out that you need an adequate run-up time to put a new system in place, and I think that's what this addresses.
Okay, thank you. Sarah Nelson.
I would echo those comments, and I was wondering, is there any way in this amendment we could include the Secretary of State's current ORSTAR system so that gives them time to work out the glitches in their system? As I understand, it's a really pretty decent system, but we are having some lateness of filings, and things are just not working out well. So I don't know if that's possible. But
okay. Thank you. Senator Montes-Anderson, any comments on that one?
No, I'm covering.
Anybody in the audience wishing to testify on the electronic filing system? Okay, great. Moving on to civil penalties, and Mr. Bennett, I know you want to testify on 6. This is moving to Dash 7 amendments. It allows the GSPC to impose penalties without following lengthy procedures when people fail to file amendments. And the other issue that we would like to address, which has not yet been addressed in the amendment, is allowing GSPC to issue a letter of reprimand. So, questions, comments? Sheriff Ferrioli.
It would be extremely logical that that we would allow the GSPC the discretion to look at a fact set and say, use it as a teaching tool, rather than requiring them always to assess a fine or to issue a letter of reprimand. So the idea here would be to just give them an additional tool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if they found an honest misunderstanding or a set of facts that was compelling, they could write a nasty gram as opposed to assessing a fine.
Senator Johnson?
I actually like what Senator Farioli just said. Right now, this is all punitive, and I don't know if there is a teachable moment in some of this stuff so that we would give them the flexibility to issue a letter of correction or a letter of education or a letter of reprimand. I mean, I could see this going through a continuum where somebody who's made an honest mistake doesn't end up with a letter of reprimand in their file, but rather ends up with a letter of correction.
Yeah.
I think we're all in agreement that we want the commission and to have the as many tools as possible in the toolbox.
Right, and I'm now arguing the semantics,
okay,
so that it isn't called a letter of reprimand.
Okay. Other thoughts on the committee? Letter of reprimand, letter of correction.
Yeah.
Want to give the commission the greatest flexibility?
Or letter of assessment.
I don't care what they call it. I do care what they call it. There's a big difference between reprimand and correction. And I think something that suggests that this is not punitive or but it's a teachable moment. That's what I want to get to. And I'm not sure we're prepared to sit here and wordsmith it. I'd leave it to them in rule. But there's a difference between guiding someone back to the right path and whacking them for something.
Everybody okay?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mr. Rutlinger, is that enough information for you? Okay. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on the civil penalties -7 amendments and the potential -whatever number regarding letter of reprimand or a letter of correction or whatever the wonderful legislative council might call it? Okay. All right. Subsequent employment, we've got the -8 amendments. I believe this is also from last week. It essentially is a sit-out provision requiring legislators to sit out a session before they can lobby. So, Senator John, you're just coughing.
Yep.
Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you. I had my staff intern, who's a Willamette law student, look at the possible constitutionality of this. And she gave me a lot of things regarding the right to engage in a chosen business, occupation, or profession without unreasonable governmental interference or deprivation thereof is a liberty and property right protected under due process. And there are several cases, Minnelli versus State in 1966 and General Electric versus Wall in 1956 and even one from 1892. Anyway, that one probably would have to be reviewed, but I would like to have a little bit of clarification because as someone who would be unemployed if I was not elected next time around, and I have certainly earned a lot of expertise in this body, I may very well be very useful to the process. So I do have an issue with this.
Thank you, Senator Montes-Anderson. Mr. Rutlinger, do you want to address that, and then we'll talk about what the Law Commission discussion was.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Montes-Anderson. A law that prohibits somebody from lobbying does raise constitutional issues because it, first of all, prohibits lobbying, which is protected speech. The Oregon Supreme Court threw out a law that established a $50 registration fee for lobbyists. And in that case, they specifically said, well, yes, lobbying is protected expression under the Oregon Constitution. So this law does raise constitutional issues. And under the analysis that the Supreme Court uses for free expression, we've tried to write it so that it's not directed specifically at the content of speech, but instead is directed at a perceived harm that the legislature can regulate, which is using official position to obtain a job later. And that's the way that it is attempted. That's the way we wrote it, so that it's directed at the harm and not specifically at the speech. But it would be fair to say that this provision does raise constitutional issues, and A court might or might uphold it and might not, depending on how they analyzed these words.
Sir Nelson.
Well, that brings really up a good point, I think, because we're assuming there's going to be harm. There might be good, too. I mean, somebody might have expertise in the healthcare field and actually do something good for the system. I mean,
what an amazing concept.
Oh, gosh. So I think I would tend to agree with Senator Moniz Anderson on this thing.
Okay. Other comments, Senator Johnson?
I keep being drawn back to the idea of some pecuniary relationship where a person either seeks the offer of a job or is being paid by a lobbying firm while they still serve in the legislature. I keep trying to track this back to the money piece of it, and I don't know whether or not there's a relationship there. I'm making this up as I go along, which is obvious, but I'm trying to figure out, instead of cutting off someone's ability to come in and exercise their free speech to advocate on an issue that they feel passionately about, and coming in and having paid clients, and I'm just trying to see if there's a money connection that we could hang something on.
Okay. Ms. Johnson, do you want to talk about the work that the Law Commission did on this issue and the resolution there?
Thank you. Chair Brown, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Senator Johnson, Professor Lindy would be very happy with your making it up as you went along, because that's exactly Professor Lindy's take on this issue. As a First Amendment scholar, Oregon Constitution scholar, his focus has always been on the money part of it. And in your dash eights, you'll see on line four, financial gain, that it's obtain financial gain. It does not prohibit a legislator who leaves legislative office from coming back to this body and you know, raising an issue or lobbying a bill, as long as they're not receiving money for that. So they can argue their points like any other citizen. It's just the financial part of it. So it is focused on the harm and the conduct, not on the speech. And then to address Senator Moniz Anderson's question, in the cases that you raised, I'm not sure if those are Oregon cases or federal cases. I'm guessing they're federal because Oregon doesn't have a due process clause. So they're First Amendment cases. And under the federal analysis, Congress does restrict itself. It has a revolving door prohibition that's been upheld as constitutional. So the question isn't whether it's unlawful under federal constitution, to my understanding, is because the feds have spoken on that issue, that it's perfectly okay for Congress to restrict on a revolving door. So the only question is it constitutional under Oregon Constitution? And it's an unanswered question. And as Senior Deputy Legislative Counselor Ted Ritlinger has pointed out, it does raise issues. There are cases on point that talk about how lobbying is speech. In the Law Commission's recommendation, it focused on the financial gain part of it and restricting whether you're receiving money to lobby. This dash 8 focuses on the same thing. You know, whether what the Supreme Court will do with it, I don't know, but the argument is there that it is constitutional because it's focused on a harm and it's focused on the gain, not on the First Amendment or the free speech right of it.
Ms. Johnson, and my recollection from the statutes, and Mr. Lutlinger could probably answer this question as well, is that there are other lobbying prohibitions in the statute based on the job folks are doing and the financial gain piece. For example, a member of the Public Utilities Commission is prohibited from taking a job specifically after there's a period of time, 1 year or 2 years or whatever, after leaving the commission. They can't go represent a corporation for which they had regulatory authority over. And presumably that would also include lobbying as well. So, all right, other questions?
I still have an issue with it. I see what you're saying about gain, but if it is a person's right to have an occupation to earn a living, and this is the one profession that they could get a job at this point in time after they don't come back into the office, to me, I think that's an infringement upon my own property right. And I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not.
Chair Brown, Senator Monitor Sanderson, I think the only response I could formulate on that is that lobbying in Oregon is narrow. It only focuses on lobbying the legislature and, as the Law Commission would recommend, to extend it to lobbying the executive branch. It doesn't prohibit you from lobbying locals or those types of things. That's a different, some locals are regulating now, City of Portland, for example, but it's a very narrow regulation of lobbying under these laws, and it would obviously be a restriction on what employment you could take afterwards. And the question is obviously a policy question for this body of whether that restriction is needed or not and whether it's a good policy.
Sir Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I understand the free speech issue, and I think that that's a question that has not been answered. That's clear from the testimony. What I'm hearing Senator Monis Anderson raise is a restraint of trade issue. And I wonder if you'd care to comment on if that was part of the discussion or part of the research behind this issue.
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, in the Law Commission's recommendation, which is very similar to this recommendation, the Law Commission and the work group discussed that issue, recognizing both issues. And as Senator Brown has noted, many present public officials are restricted in what jobs they can take next. There's a whole list of folks who, you know, the treasurer's office, the public utility, there's tribal gaming persons. There's a whole list of folks, and they're restricted for 2 years, and some of them, from going into the industry, period, not just lobbying. And so it was deemed that this restriction on lobbying was a narrow restriction. Yeah. It didn't prohibit you from going into politics or doing consulting work or anything, but it was the narrow restriction on you can't lobby the very folks that you used to work with as a part of the same body for a year. Thank you.
Anything further?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ferrioli.
Actually, I'll be very interested in seeing how the free speech issue is finally resolved, because it's my intention to try to expand the prohibitions on the revolving door to include legislators that might move into state agencies as the directors, or lobbyists who might end up as state agencies or in the administrative branch of government in positions of authority. And my feeling there is if you need a cooling off period for a distancing effect on the conflict of interest, there's an awful lot of folks that we're leaving out of that equation that might benefit from that cooling off period as well.
Comments. Senator Nelson.
I mean, the lobbying is a very important part of this whole system, and for us to restrain somebody in any manner, shape, or form seems to me to not be for the benefit of the system. And as a realistic thing, I would say most legislators would make terrible lobbyists. And probably
and
do.
They have done.
I mean, in the real world, that's what happens.
Thank you, Senator Nelson, for that editorial comment. I was looking for the audience to see if there is anyone in the audience wishing to testify on that issue, particularly like Mr. Bennett. But Mr. Burson has raised his hand and let Mr. Bennett off the hook. Come on up, Mr. Burson. Oh, Senator Johnson.
I don't want to pass over a comment that my colleague, Senator Ferrioli, made, and it feels like we are. I think we ought to remember why we're undertaking this exercise, why the Law Commission spent 18 months working on the suite of bills that they have, and that is that we're trying to restore the public's confidence that we know what we're doing and that we're behaving in ethical ways that are above reproach. And some of this conversation has felt a little like, how are we trying to accommodate people that are in the process? And I think we're losing track of the prize, which is, how do we restore the public confidence in what we're doing? And the point that I don't want to lose is agency people taking contracts with vendors. The perception that folks are moving around inside state government, state agency heads leaving one position and ending up in created positions other places. I think we got to remember that what we're here to do is to have Oregonians believe that we are behaving appropriately and in the best interest and service to our state, not making sure that we're protecting our own our own rights to come back into the building and make money. And I say that respectfully because I think Senator Monis Anderson raises some important points. But I don't want to lose this issue. I think the distancing and the cooling off is very valuable, and I think it cuts across more than just legislators returning to these halls as advocates. It certainly has to do with agency behavior, and I think it includes the executive branch as well.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. As Senator Farioli is aware, that is a topic that will be covered in the law commission bills, which we'll be hearing in a couple of weeks. Senator Farioli and I have had that conversation a number of times, but we're going to, Ms. Johnson, do you want to tell us briefly while we're tackling this issue what the law commission proposals look at in that area in terms of contracting and agencies, et cetera?
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. In the area of subsequent employment, I think it's fair to say we have three major things that we're covering in our bill. One would be a revolving door prohibition on the legislators for a year. Second, clarifying when you can accept a job, a subsequent job, that you can't be accepting a job from someone who has a matter before you. You need to take yourself off that matter before you start in negotiations. That's a rule that's already prohibited by public lawyers who can't go to the other side, but it's not a provision that applies to public officials, so folks can be negotiating with new employers while they're sitting there. It looks like a conflict, and some people may disclose it as such, but they're not required to take themselves off, and so we add that provision. And third, we add a provision, we're recommending that provision that would prohibit a public official who is involved, and I don't have the wording in front of me, but involved extensively in a contract negotiation if they're the approver or negotiate that contract, that they would not be able to benefit from such a contract for, I believe, the draft is 2 years. Some contracts go for many years, and we didn't want to make it unduly restrictive, but if you're the decision maker, and then you're basically setting yourself up for your next job while you're in public office, that there's no prohibition on that presently, because the argument would be that you don't have a present conflict, then you go out and get the job, and so there's really not a way to prove that issue presently, and so it's more of an objective test that you can't receive that contract benefit for 2 years.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Burson? I can't remember why I called you up here now.
Because I asked you.
Okay, all right, great. Yeah.
Again, Ron Burson, Executive Director for the GSPC. And I just wanted to talk about this Dash 8 amendment, and one of the concerns I have as an agency head trying to enforce this provision, in that under the Dash 8, and actually in the bill, it says may not use or attempt to use a person's position as a former member to obtain that financial gain. And I believe that that makes it difficult on my agency to try to prove that point. In other words, maybe a person comes back in that was a member of the Legislative Assembly, but they were hired back in to do this work because they are an attorney or they have expertise in areas that are looking at, but they didn't hire them because they were that legislator. They hired them because of some other reasons, and this leaves that out for me. Earlier on, you'd mentioned there are some very specific language earlier on in the bill and actually in statute right now where it talks about the public utility commissioners or the Department of Administrative, Consumer and Business Services. Well, it just says if you are that, they shall not. And so it's very specific. So if it said a member of the Legislative Assembly shall not, and I'm glad that Mr. Redlinger is here on drafting this, because I understand there has been there was some thought put into that, but I'm just saying for an agency standpoint, it'd be difficult for me to prove that somebody took a lobbying position because they were a former member and not because of some other skill they might have had.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Rettlinger, any comments?
Yes, Ted Rettlinger, Legislative Council. When we drafted this both for the Law Commission and for this bill, I don't think we envisioned requiring the GSPC to have to make that determination. I mean, what everybody wants this to mean is that a former member of the legislature may not obtain financial gain for being a lobbyist. And this additional language was put in there specifically to address the Oregon Supreme Court's analytical method, where you're trying to address a specific harm. And maybe we didn't get there, but I don't think it was our intent, and it wasn't mine in writing it for this bill, to require GSPC to have to determine whether or not the person used their office. What it should mean is that It is simply assumes that you have used your office if you are obtaining financial gain as a lobbyist for a period of time after you leave the legislature.
Okay. All right. Sarah Ferrielli.
Madam Chair, I think I see where the GSPC executive director is coming from. It offers or invites an affirmative defense for the person under investigation. It was because I am an attorney, have a specific body of knowledge obtained elsewhere, and I can see them getting involved in the affirmative defense process, and it could be a lot less clear than just prohibition. But, Madam Chair, if I could, as long as Mr. Rettlinger's gone into the issue of harm, how am I to define the harm here? Can you point to the harm that's encompassed in this issue that we're trying to prevent?
I believe, based upon the discussions during the Law Commission, that the harm is a member of the legislature using their position to end up with a paid lobbying position after they leave the legislature. And Wendy can correct me if I've misstated that, but I think that's the harm, and that's why it was written this way.
Ms. Johnson, you agree?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, yes, we would agree that that was the intent behind it. In other words, if you just put a shall not, you're not providing that legislative history, that explanation of tying a restriction on speech to the harm. And so that's why it is longer than the shall not.
And legislators currently are prohibited from using their office for financial gain. Is that correct?
There are some. You said legislators.
Legislators.
Right. That's the general prohibition.
Right.
And then there are all these exceptions.
Yes. Senator Nelson.
That's seeming kind of interesting because I think the legislature, just by the fact of being elected, obtains a personal gain at some point. While it's like it changes your life, basically. It's like going on to learning a skill or something. You go to do something, and you can't take that back. I mean, this is a unique occupation, and you have a personal gain regardless of what happens. By being elected.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. I appreciate that. I'm going to bring us back to Senator Johnson's point about what we're trying to do here, and I think the goal is to restore Oregonians' faith in their legislature and their government as a whole, and I certainly hear your concerns, Senator Nelson, Senator Montes-Anderson, but I think what we're trying to do is restore people's faith, not lessen it and make the loopholes broader than they are. So at that point, unless anybody else in the audience is wishing to testify on subsequent employment, we're going to move on. And Mr. Rettlinger, why don't you just hang on we're almost done here, but just so you don't have to keep coming back and forth. Obviously, two issues, gift piece, we're going to have to track down the issue that Ms. Johnson raised earlier. And then secondly, I know there's been some questions about the travel piece of the exemption in the gift provision. My staff has had contact with NCSL, National Conference of State Legislators, Council State Governments, Senate President's Forum, and several national organizations, including Nobel. And just to give an example for the record, NCSL has indicated they are not a 503c3, but rather, quote, an instrumentality of the several states, end quote, as defined by the federal tax code. So we're going to be looking into this issue a little bit further because we would hate for you to be prohibited from attending an NCSL forum simply because the language is too narrow and wouldn't apply to NCSL forums, and they've invited you to come to participate in a workshop on whatever, ethics, for example. So I'll be in contact with all of you over the next week as we clarify that. So, Senator Johnson.
One other thing that I just don't want to lose track of in this, I clearly see the value of NCSL and CSG and the Senate President's Forum. We have legislators participating in a variety of other activities, some of them of great value, and some of them I would submit to you of pretty questionable value. And I don't know in what forum we review what we're going to consider a worthy expenditure of public money to have legislators participate in, whether or not those raise any ethical issues. And I just, we're focusing on, I think, the higher end, and I would include Penoir in the higher end stuff, the Pacific Northwest
economic region.
Thank you. But some of this other stuff, I just am flagging it as an issue that somewhere we ought to talk about. And maybe that's a budget issue, or maybe it's the presiding officers to review the things that we have people appointed to, wherein travel to exotic places is involved, and that there's some value realized for it, and the requirements for attendance and those sorts of things, whether you're just going to some exotic place and you show up for 2 minutes worth of meetings and the rest of the time is on the golf course. So I want to just flag that as a concern.
And I really appreciate your concerns, and I think the language in the bill was intended to, frankly, really narrow the types of organizations that legislators can travel to, having been paid for by the organization. I think if you look at the language, it really narrows it. Just for the record, NCSL, National Conference of State Legislatures, and Council of State Governments, and I believe PENWAR, were organizations to which the state of Oregon pays dues to. And generally speaking, those two organizations are funded. The majority of their dollars comes from state fees. In terms of the spirit of the proposal, they would be exempted from the spirit. It's simply because of how they're described under the tax code that would prohibit us from taking stipends, et cetera, from NCSL. So I think it's fairly narrow. If folks wish to go narrower, I'm happy to have that conversation. I do think there's some other forums, and I frankly don't know where we draw the line. A Senate President's Forum is a really good example of that. There's also foundations that probably some receive their dollars from private entities. So there are a number of trips that folks can are invited to participate in, women in government, that probably would not be included under the language of this, so folks would be on their own to pay for those trips. And so the issue is we're not prohibiting people from traveling. We're prohibiting the travel from being paid for by the organization.
That's exactly right, and I would nuance it just slightly farther. At the end of the day, we're parsing now what kind of organization. I go back to my premise that it's the very fact that a legislator from Oregon showed up in Santa Barbara staying at the Ritz-Carlton that people justifiably find offensive.
Thank you. When it's paid for by certain folks.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, if you're writing the check out of your own pocket, have a nice trip. Bon voyage. If somebody else is paying for it, I think Oregonians justifiably can see concern there.
Thank you. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Milbank Foundation, I have to put this on record, is an organization that I have, where they draw legislators from all over the United States to talk about health care. It's solely, it's a trust that was established by someone long time ago to do this very thing, bring legislators together to discuss health care. It's been invaluable for me as a legislator, and I know that members from our agency have taken advantage of it too. So I want to make sure that that organization is still within this, because they aren't getting money from lobby. It's a trust that they have.
Okay.
So
okay. We'll take a look at that, Senator Montes Anderson. So, all right, moving along on last page, there's six amendments, and I believe this was an amendment in response to Ms. Thompson's concerns about the prohibition was too broad, and that we narrowed allowed you to pay for certain violations out of your campaign account. It's the -6 amendment. Any concerns about that one?
Do you think they'll, Madam Chair,
Senator Montes Anderson,
are there going to be any loopholes that this amendment's going to create? And I'm not sure where I'm going with this.
We'll have Ms. Thompson come up.
Developing, separate accounts.
For lack of the, your concern about a legislator, for example, using campaign dollars to pay for a home mortgage payment or something to that effect, would this amendment allow any ethics fines to be paid out of, would prohibit ethics fines being paid out of campaign dollars? So is that what you're looking at?
Well, I was thinking more setting up another account that people could pay into instead. So it wouldn't really be your PAC. It would be another account. To me, that I see a loophole.
Thompson.
I think there's a couple things going on. One is I believe it's in Senate Bill 10. If it's not, it's one of the Law Commission bills coming up. It's hard to keep all this straight. Is allowing the formation of these legal defense funds.
Section 36.
Thank you. And so.
Sorry, 28. It starts on Section 28.
It is confusing.
So one of the reasons, you know, I think the Law Commission felt okay about, you know, some of these restrictions on use of campaign funds relates to providing for another mechanism to raise money with disclosure, et cetera, with some oversight from the GSPC for legal and other fines coming up from these kinds of things. What I was trying to say when I testified before was that my thought was to allow use of campaign funds just for violations of 232, which are just the C&E related fines. But in that testimony, I specified an example of another 260 violation, 260.407, where candidates are not to use campaign funds for personal use as a good example of a violation that it did not seem appropriate for use of campaign funds, and that's what this amendment does, and I support the amendment. If there's our fines for that particular violation, fundraising can occur in the legal defense fund to, you know, to deal with that issue. I do think if you're going to take the approach of like just saying that there's, you know, a few of these things that aren't okay, I would argue that there's another one. 260.409 is a restriction that, as I recall, was put into place as part of last year's House Bill 3458, where a candidate committee may not compensate a candidate for professional services performed by the candidate. And I would argue that's another example of a violation that, if it occurred, is really not the kind of thing that we should allow use of campaign funds for. And again, partly I think we can make that distinction because they have the option of this legal defense fund. And I think I didn't say who I was for the record. Janice Thompson with the Money and Politics Research Action Project. My apologies.
Madam Chair.
Let me make sure Senator Montes Anderson got her question answered.
So you're saying that, yes, a legal defense fund could be set up by a candidate. And,
right.
And yeah.
That's
all
clearly
right.
In Senate Bill 10. Thank you for reminding me.
But to clarify that, then what monies could go into that?
There would be, Senator Montes Anderson, the candidate or the public official involved would do fundraising, saying, I need help with this, and here's the process. And the legislation is very clear about that there are reporting requirements, and they're kind of filed, you know, set up in conjunction with the GSPC. So it's really mapped out. So, but it's just saying that people need another option for these kinds of legal fees or fines, and we need to set up this option, but it would be a separate type of fundraising.
Thank you. Senator Farrielly.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm reminded of a comment that Ken Rocco often makes to us in legislative fiscal, and that's actually I've heard it in legislative revenue as well, that we often shoot behind the deck in trying to forecast the rise or fall of revenue. This seems to be an example of shooting behind the deck. When you suggested that we ought to take a look at prohibitions of the candidate, hiring the candidate to do consulting on the candidate's work, you know, on the campaign, just as you just did, I think you're shooting behind the deck because it's a spectacularly uninspired person who couldn't think of the candidate's spouse or the candidate's child, you know, to hire as their campaign consultant, as we saw in the Portland race, and as we have seen in several other races. So what I'm trying to get across here is the greater the specificity, you know, you think you're creating a secure system, and really you're just creating alternatives for people to game the system.
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, I don't disagree with you. I think that would then be a matter of strengthening current law in 260.409 that says candidate committee shall not compensate candidate for professional services performed by the candidate. I mean, I think you're raising a whole other issue, which is if you're concerned about that kind of category of activity, then expand that law. I'm saying that this liked 260.407, which is the subject of one set of the Dash 6 amendments, that's a particular violation that just really isn't like an inadvertent, you know, C&E disclosure error or, you know, missing a deadline for a couple. I mean, that's just more, a little bit more egregious, abusive, you know. And that's why I say it's a category where campaign funds should not be allowed to be used, particularly since there's this legal defense fund, that also rationale also applies to the 260.409 violations. And, you know, a whole other discussion could be expanding the scope of the 260.409 violations related to compensation of candidates for professional services.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
I agree. I mean, I think that's an egregious, intentional violation. It's trying to turn a candidacy into a profession. And I think we should prohibit the use of campaign funds to pay fines that come from that. But then that begs the question, well, how do you meet the letter of the law and accomplish the same nefarious objective? You just move one step away from the candidacy. You know, the candidate hires the spouse, or the candidate hires the child, or the candidate hires the householder. And the point is you could begin to expand the section, the 260 section, till you encompass the entire known universe, and you still won't have created a system that can't be gamed. We just can't keep piling on detail after detail. But to your original point, I think you're right. That's an egregious violation. Candidates should not be allowed to compensate themselves for running for office. And I think that's what you're after.
Okay. Sarah Nelson.
I would like to hear from the director at some point on this issue, how he would handle it on the ground, the practical aspects of this law. I think we're missing something there when we're saying how are we going to actually implement this. He brought up the point in his last testimony, is that, well, this is really going to be hard for me to make this determination. Are we going to have the same issue in this case?
Ms. Thompson, why don't you respond? Mr. Burson, why don't you come on up?
Senator Nelson, Chair Brown, these 260 violations are election law violations, which are, I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
They're within the purview of the Secretary of State's office in the Elections Division, not the GSPC.
Well, I'm confused between what they're doing here and the Secretary of State. I thought I was bringing up the 85-page booklet a little while ago and said, well, that doesn't apply here. But now that it applies, I mean, that's I think, the whole issue here.
Chair Brown, Senator Nelson. Both the Public Commission on the Legislature and the Law Commission, in its scope of respective scopes of work, have introduced legislation, some of which is reflected in Senate Bill 10, relating to use of campaign funds. So that's why they're showing up. And the bulk of Senate Bill 10 and the bulk of the Law Commission has to do with GSPC activities, but they're not completely, you can't completely like tear them apart. And so that's where you're going to see this, and I think that, in general, when you see 260, think Secretary of State. When you see 240, I believe it's 240. 244. 244. Think Mr. Burson.
How about in specifics? Helpful. In general, I suppose.
Well, that's big picture. There's going to, as Ms. Thompson pointed out, there's going to be some intersecting. And I don't know what, I have not seen the notebook you're talking about, so I don't know what that is in regard to that the Secretary, I assume, I don't know if it's a rules or some Secretary of State's office. Ms. Thompson?
Chair Brown, I believe it's the C&E manual.
Okay. So that's contribution and expense. That's campaign. That's not ethics. So some of it's interrelated again because campaign dollars, at least under current law, can be used to defray the cost of your office.
Yeah,
I mean, so there is, you can't totally rip it apart. Okay. I don't know. Why don't you guys stay right there and we'll run through the last three amendments. That way you don't have to get up and come back up in case we need you. So I've had a number of meetings with Senator Farioli. He's made a number of suggestions, just for the record, some of which we're going to delay until we bring back the Law Commission bills, which will be up over the next week or so. We're working on having a incredibly interesting and fascinating joint hearing with the House Rules Committee. It will probably be in the evening, given all of our heavy committee load, so just to warn you. So some of the issues that Senator Farioli has raised will be addressed in the Law Commission proposals. He has three amendments that I'd like you all to consider. The first is, instead of requiring reports to be filed electronically, we'll request it to be optional for the filer, especially for public officials without computer access. I do think this probably needs to be sunsetted at some point, but we would then require that the GSPC post the electronic image of the paper statement of economic interest. Mr. Burson, do you want to say anything in addition to that? You don't have to.
Chair Brown, the only concern I have is I don't know what the system looks like right now.
Okay.
So to say how I would post it, but I would agree that we would post that information electronically for Oregonians to look at.
All right. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that very much, and I understand the constraints. I mean, we're all talking about a theoretical and hypothetical system here, but the real, you know, the real toad in this garden occurred in the Secretary of State's office when they absolutely refused to accept paper filings. And some folks who filed electronically have gone back to their files and found that the data's gone. And the Secretary of State absolutely refuses to accept even time-stamped paper copies that show they were filed timely. So, you know, in this transition to an electronic filing system, there needs to be a testing period, a ramp-up time, and confidence in the system so that people, when they, maybe it's not that they don't have a computer, it's just that they don't trust the technology and they want a paper file because that's what they hold in their hand. So it's really to accommodate that kind of transition more than anything else.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I wouldn't mind if there was some kind of a trajectory, a multi-year trajectory to debug and get everybody ramped up.
Yeah. That would be acceptable, okay. For sure.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions for that? Let's move on to bundling. As many of us know, bundling has been one of the huge issues in terms of avoiding reporting requirements. Senator Farioli and the Republican caucus has asked that we prohibit bundling of gifts from lobbyists, to prohibit lobbyists from splitting the cost of a gift, meal, or travel into small enough segments to avoid the reporting threshold. So Mr. Rutling will be working with us to draft that particular concept. Any comments or questions?
I'm sure if we did nothing else, I think this is the issue that people are really spun up about, and that's the fact that folks were advised they could avoid reporting requirements by bundling, and that legislators were given advice, sometimes by attorneys, that they didn't have to report because of the number of sponsors divided by the cost fell below the reporting requirement. So, Madam Chair, I would just submit to you that if we did nothing else but took bundling out of the equation, it would force a lot of folks to do the reporting that's required on both ends of the equation, the giver and the recipient.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. And the good news is we're not going to do nothing else, particularly in thanks to the work of the Law Commission. Ms. Thompson, then Mr. Burson.
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, that is a very important issue. It's something that I've worked with Senator Brown on legislation in the past. I think you have some past legislative history on this. Basically, I would particularly refer you to, I believe Utah passed some legislation that we reviewed earlier to get at the notion that, you know, you can't quite do this lumping. But another approach, which I would recommend, is the I'll call it the Minnesota approach, which is say anything, we're not going to worry about anything under $5 or, you know, under, you know, very low de minimis level, but then everything else has to, is just reported. So, and that part of the reason that kind of bundling and, you know, playing games, it was documented very well back in 2000, 2001 in some registered guard reporting, is because the threshold just gets to be high enough that people can start to play games with it. So you could also just bring it down.
Thank you. Mr. Burson?
Yes, one other issue I'd like to bring up, and since we're talking about this issue of bundling, this is one that's come up recently, in that the way these events are paid for is that you are attending the event actually pays your PAC, and the PAC actually pays your expenses. And so it's, again, that I think it's Senator Farioli had said earlier, that gone that one step kind of away from the trouble. And if, I know Mr. Redlinger has a ton of work to do, but in the same idea that, again, and I know the intention here is not to, you know, not report this information. And so we would like to bring that issue up too and try to prevent that from happening also.
Okay. So let's think of Planned Parenthood has a dinner. And they invite legislators, and the tab is $150 a plate. For legislators who couldn't afford to go to that dinner, you're saying they couldn't pay for that out of their PAC if they received a financial contribution from Planned Parenthood at some point in the previous year or the following year?
Chair Brown, the example I was using was the specific reason for the trip was
okay.
to obtain your campaign contribution that would go into your PAC.
Got it.
And
okay.
the PAC itself would actually pay for your travel, food, and entertainment.
Ms. Johnson?
This is an issue I feel really strongly about, and it occurs to me that changing the mindset of some of the organizations that want legislators there might be part of preventing this pass-through. I am completely sympathetic to the situation that you described, because every one of us gets asked to multiple events over and over again. And you don't want to sit there and not eat while everybody else is, because it looks weird. And some people can't afford, and it makes people uncomfortable, and it's just not a good situation. I think that perhaps changing the thinking of some of the organizations, if they want legislators there, they figure out a mechanism to make that completely transparent, that there are comp tickets or
then it's a gift.
Yeah, that won't work. Sorry.
Anyway, but no, I hear exactly what you're saying, Senator Johnson, Senator Farioli.
Can I just say one more?
Oh, sure, sure. It's
there's also, I think, a big difference about attending an event and buying the tables. Often now the question comes to us, would you like to attend the XYZ worthy event, ticket $120, or do you want to sponsor a table, $1,200? And I don't know whether there's some way to see our way through through that issue. I think the real question is it's the transparency of the application of the funds and whether it can be solved with reporting. The idea of all of this passing through of campaign money to various places, I think, is something that is of legitimate concern. And if it's reported and still occurs, that might be one solution. But the fact that it isn't reported and occurs, I think, is worrisome.
Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I think that, you know, I can see the time slipping away. I think we need to really have a greater understanding of this issue and this discussion. And I just will point out that two of the people sitting at the dais here raised between the two of them about $3 million for campaigns in the last legislative cycle. And that we did a lot of traveling in a lot of different places, and the campaign PACs paid for that travel. So if what you're trying to do is eliminate the solicitation of funds for campaigns and travel, that is expressly not okay.
I think Mr. Burson is getting, can we just be very blunt here? More specifically,
yeah, I got
an organization paying for a trip to a offshore facility and that you have to go to the hotel or whatever in order to pick up the campaign check. Isn't that the concern that you have?
Madam Chair, yes. And I don't want to be misunderstood in that I don't want a PAC to be able to pay for travel. What I'm saying is my belief is that this type of action is taking place so that it does not need to be reported.
And this is the Maui trip, right?
Reported.
Mr. Burson, this is the Maui situation that we're talking about?
That is the situation that I brought
okay.
up.
Sarah Johnson.
I've never made that trip, Madam Chairman.
Sarah Johnson.
Well, and the other thing, more explicit, I'm looking at Chuck Bennett. He would never engage in any nefarious activity. But Chuck can't pay for me to go to Hawaii. But he can make a campaign contribution to my PAC, and I can pay for my own trip to Hawaii. And that's weird.
Well, thank you, Senator Johnson. This whole issue of what you can do with your campaign dollars is being discussed in the public. I can't remember the name of the Senate committee.
Legislative
Operations Committee. And Senator Monroe is looking at that issue. Tuesday. Thank you. Okay. No, hang on just a minute. Ms. Thompson has a comment, and then we need to, wrap up one last issue. So... You okay, Senator Farrielly?
Yeah, I've got to leave, so I thought I would help you wrap up that last.
Oh, thank you, Senator Farrielly. Go ahead.
Well, the previous discussion, I think, points to the fact that we would rather see no emergency clause put on this legislation, so that when the dust settles, whatever the configuration looks like, people have an opportunity to climb up that learning curve. So an emergency clause would put this into effect in a point where people would fall off that cliff. And I don't want to play gotcha with 90 members of the legislature.
Thank you, Senator Farrielly. I think you and your members have raised an excellent point, and we probably won't die on our sword on that one. And I think Mr. Burson would be greatly relieved if there was no emergency clause.
Madam Chairman, we should put the penalties in the bill for Mr. Burson failing to enforce the law.
Okay. Thank you. And I was going to say I misspoke. I did not misspeak, but the information I had was there were going to be a joint House and Senate Rules Committee regarding the Law Commission bills. Apparently, given the complexities, shall I say, of everyone's calendar, that is proving extremely difficult unless we were to do it at 5 a.m. So wanting to continue to be well-liked, if not well-respected by my committee members, we stay tuned in terms of what we're going to be able to do in terms of a joint meeting with the House Rules Committee. Senator Johnson.
I'd like to make a case for a joint meeting because it strikes me that we've got a whole lot of parallel trains running down parallel tracks. We've got Senate Bill 10. We've got
actually, can I just stop you right there?
Yes,
unbeknownst to the members here, the Senate Rules Committee Chair and the House Rules Committee Chair, along with our committee staff, are meeting quite extensively. And on some issues, there is an agreement on most of these issues to either move forward in the Senate side first or the House side first, except where we agree to disagree. And I'll give you a really specific example of that. That's the revolving door piece. The House leadership feels very strongly about moving forward on a provision. They're going to move forward on a provision. We also feel strongly about moving forward differently. So I think we're actually, though it may not seem like it, are working very hard at being extremely well coordinated, particularly with regards to the ethics issues and all of the Law Commission bills. The Rules Committee staff, who are absolutely brilliant and fabulous, along with the caucus staffs, have been working very closely and actually coordinated with the Law Commission, which Law Commission bills were filed where and all that kind of stuff. So I appreciate that comment. We're working very hard to do that. So anything else? Breathe, everyone. If we just be forewarned, if we can't get the amendment done by next Thursday, we don't want to kill Mr. Ruttlinger before we even get started on the other ethics pieces, the Law Commission stuff. We will probably be focusing on executive appointments next week, but other than that, we'll be looking forward to a work session on the bill as quickly as possible. Anything else? Thank you. We're adjourned.